one of the most popular anthems of the 80s, Nina's 99 Red Balloons, was a German song about how buying some balloons at a gift shop and letting them go for fun was then hastily taken as hostile, unidentified objects by both sides, with opposing nations scrambling planes and going on full alert to counteract a perceived nuclear attack. When in fact, it was the most childlike of things, just some balloons. Nina's guitarist, Carlo, got the idea for the song at a Rolling Stones concert in West Berlin. At one point during the show, the band released a bunch of balloons, and Carlo watched as one of the balloons drifted over a wall into East Berlin. He imagined a radar picking up the one balloon and mistaking it for an enemy plane. Carlo wrote the lyrics, and Nina's keyboard player wrote the music. The song is ultimately about the dreams of the German people that were lost after World War II. The 99 balloons represent the many dreams that each person had, and at the end of the song, she just wants to prove that the German people did have dreams by finding one balloon. She finds one balloon, a dream, and lets it go. German people have always had those among them that dreamed big, and that made significant contributions to humanity, with a prime example being Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, a poet, playwright, scientist, statesman, artist, and novelist considered the greatest German literary figure of the modern era. Fluent in 5 languages, Goethe was inspired by ancient Persia, which is modern Iran, and was not only influenced by Rumi, but devoted his collection of poems called West Eastern Divan to the Iranian poet Hafez. Goethe considered literature, language, and religion as the best aids to understanding ancient cultures, and he studied the teachings of Zoroaster, one of the pre-Christian religious figures of the Aryan people, as well as cuneiform inscriptions in Iran, near the ancient Persian capital of Persepolis, made 2,500 years ago by Darius the Great and Cyrus the Great, pertaining to their self-designated Aryan lineage and ancestry. Of course, the ancient Aryans were not limited to the Iranian nobility, but also made up the noble caste of northern India, including the lineage of Gautama Buddha, as well as the earliest Chinese emperors, including forgotten civilizations that littered the Chinese landscape with massive pyramids that rival the ones found in Egypt and Mesoamerica. This mythical demographic of people who are academically recognized as disseminating what became known as the Indo-European branch of languages were also influential in the Mediterranean, sharing genetic and cultural affinities with the Phoenicians and populations that became prominent in the Levant. Because of ancient wars in the area around what is known as modern-day Israel, many tribes that comprised those that the Bible regards as Israelites fled into various parts of Europe, in many cases merging into what are now known as royal families, recognizable by their crest symbology, particularly a lion with its tongue sticking out, or in various crosses, such as the one made famous by the Knights Templar, which actually predates Christianity itself. The Bible also records ancient conflicts between northern Israelites and southern tribes which are collectively known as Judah, whose symbol incidentally is a lion, but includes people who were later converted and incorporated into the Jewish nation around the 2nd century BC. This includes a group in particular known as the Edomites in the book of Genesis. Edom in Hebrew means red, just like the word Phoenician comes from a Greek word meaning red. According to the Bible, they were descendants of Jacob's brother Esau, who was said to be red-headed and possibly reddish in complexion, but I would argue that there's a deeper esoteric meaning to the color red in regards to the use of red ochre paint, which represented blood and, more importantly, life-giving forces. A similar reverence to red ochre was present in ancient Egypt, also among the ancient Minoans, Mycenaeans, Etruscans, and the Native American and Western European population associated with the Basque, known as the Maritime Archaic or Red Paint People, that were known for transatlantic travel going back over 8,000 years. Red ochre is iron oxide, and when mixed with animal fat, produces a red paint that also acts as an effective sunscreen and can also be effective in the treatment of spear wounds, as well as repelling insects such as mosquitoes. There's a genetic and cultural link between now extinct Native American tribes, once known as Redskin Indians, because of the red ochre paint that they applied to their fair skin, and ancient Canaanites also associated with the color red. And this link helps to explain why so much of the copper mined in Michigan in antiquity is missing and unaccounted for in the archaeological record of the New World, and where all the copper that ushered in the Bronze Age in the Old World came from. The reason that transatlantic contact during the entire duration of the Holocene, and possibly longer, is not common knowledge today can be traced back to the Punic Wars, which is when the Roman Empire crushed and ended the Phoenician Empire, and essentially wrote them out of history, except to vilify them as they were defeated rivals, and history is written by the winners. The Roman Empire eventually collapsed and was reinvented as the Holy Roman Empire, and its perspective was continued and perpetrated by the Catholic Church. In fact, the word propaganda is a Latin word, the official language of the Roman Empire, used by the Catholic Church starting in the 1600s as part of the Counter-Reformation and its attempt to propagate its religious and political point of view, which did not include things like the earth revolving around the sun, or that civilized or genetically and culturally related populations existed in places like the New World. We now know that there was a modern human presence in Mexico as far back as 33,000 years ago, which is around 20,000 years earlier than currently accepted evidence suggests, supporting theories that either Solutrean people from Europe populated the Americas during the Pleistocene, or that myths from the Egyptians, Greeks, Berbers, and Basque about an Ice Age civilization in the Atlantic called Atlantis may have at least in part been based in truth. Since Cro-Magnon man was first discovered in 1868, he has presented fundamental puzzles for traditional scientists, with no solution in sight for mainstream academia. Cro-Magnon appeared abruptly in Europe and North Africa, lasting from roughly 40,000 years ago to about 12,000 years ago, with a phenotype that is taller and with a larger cranial capacity than the average human living today. These physical characteristics are an unpleasant problem for mainstream anthropologists, because to fit in more gracefully with their politically motivated theories, Cro-Magnon should have been shorter and smaller brain than the average for humans today. However, his actual characteristics are totally in accord with the assertions of the ancient mythologies from ancient Greece, Egypt, and Mesopotamia, which all speak to prior ages being more advanced, never adhering to notions of a simian-like ancestry. I cover some of this in several prior videos, which I'll leave a link to in the description. A second and major puzzle for anthropologists is that Cro-Magnon man appears to arrive with his culture from no discernible origin. He does not show any discernible development. His culture was distinctly superior to others around him, such as Neanderthal or Homo erectus, This could be seen clearly in the nature of his tools, such as the first examples of bifacial tool technology, spears that are thrown with an atoll, or bow and arrows. His artwork was also seen to be superior, painting those cave walls that we hear so much about, and that I postulate is the first example of a 12-house zodiac, which I'll also leave a link to in the description. His culture does not appear to come from any source that we can identify, just appearing suddenly in Western Europe and North Africa, with the museum in the Canary Islands claiming to possess the largest known collection of Cro-Magnon-like skulls, with the native Guanches of these islands in the Atlantic considered the direct descendants of Cro-Magnon. The Cro-Magnon culture gives all the appearance of arriving from elsewhere already developed. Here is one of the few Upper Paleolithic drawings of a human female. Notice the relatively modern-looking, tailored clothing with sewn arms and legs, also shoes and a hat. Cro-Magnon men are sometimes depicted as clean-shaven, and even playing musical instruments. Here is an example of a Cro-Magnon burial in Russia with thousands of mammoth beads that at one time were sewn into clothing. These are civilized people who became refugees in a new land with no infrastructure. These alleged cavemen also had houses. We do not know what exactly they were made of, probably wood, but we do have the post holes. But the third and worst problem of all is that science cannot determine where his bones come from. His skeletal structure does not have any traces developing from any surrounding area. And at that, his skeletal structure, as mentioned, is not what science would like to find. To show you this yet more emphatically, here are some quotes showing the developed somewhere else nature of Cro-Magnon culture. According to Professor Francis Bord, world-renowned archaeologist and former director of the Laboratory of Prehistory at the University of Bordeaux, the Aurignacian or Cro-Magnon tool tradition without doubt originates outside of Europe, ready-made, although from where is still a mystery. Archaeologist Frank Hibben states that the Aurignacian industry is, quote, indubitably non-European in origin. Anthropologist R. Cedric Lennart says that no formative or gestation stages have ever been found on any continent for any of the Cro-Magnon tool industries. Professional anthropologists haven't the foggiest idea of the origin of these invasions. They invariably appear on the western shores of Europe and Africa, even including some of the Atlantic Isles next to those continents. Always the sites are clustered in the west, the number of sites diminishing towards the east, with the exception of the Levant. This has been a mystery that has plagued anthropologists for over 100 years. To the west, there is naught but empty ocean. How could the invasions come from there? When one considers that Cro-Magnon populated Europe during the Pleistocene, as sea levels were 400 feet lower than they are today, and islands in the Atlantic, such as the Azores and the surrounding Mid-Atlantic Ridge, had far greater surface area that was above water than they do today, then the mysterious origins of Cro-Magnon appearing from the Atlantic becomes less mysterious, especially considering that the Azores are a group of 9 islands located in the center of the Atlantic Ocean, which resemble many of the descriptions of a fabled lost island in the Atlantic. Terre Sierra is one of the larger islands with a population of 56,000 inhabitants and is located in the historical capital of the archipelago, now a UNESCO heritage site. Many people are unaware that over 140 pyramids are currently being studied by archaeologists in the Madalena area of the Pico Islands of the Azores. Some of these structures reach about 13 meters high, that's about 43 feet, which is equivalent to a 4-story building, and they seem to be aligned deliberately. The landscape features a volcano, the Ponte de Pico, which is the highest mountain in the Azores and Portugal, and the highest elevation of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The pyramids, which are built with basalt volcanic rock, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean may possibly predate the arrival of Portuguese or Spanish by many millennia. Discoveries so far have included hooks, metal spikes, bones, shells, weights for fishing nets, utensils made of basalt, coal fragments, and pieces of pottery. And this is all in the first official archaeological surveys that are authorized by the Zorz region government to the pyramid structures of the island. So these pyramids are almost all concentrated in an area of 6 kilometers in the district of Magdalena near the west coast of the island, dominated by the highest mountain, and this is about 2,350 meters. So far, archaeologists are very enthusiastic about the deposits of ancient artifacts that they found, and it seems that these artifacts are definitely constructed much earlier than 1427, which is the date of the discovery of the Azores by the Portuguese. And according to Professor Nuno Ribeiro, an archaeologist who's performing surveys on the site, and I quote, "It's an archaeological complex that includes organized pyramidal buildings that create a large square. This organization of space cannot be explained simply by the clearing of the land for agricultural purposes. So it would have required great planning and involve collection of labor and several years to build." Ribeiro goes on to add, and I quote, "More amazing is the fact that these structures satisfied the same guidelines of other pyramids around the world. Romeo Christoph, an archaeologist at the University of Texas at Austin, Texas, visited the pyramids with the following observation, quote, "The structures of Pico are very perfect and imply a huge amount of work that is justified not only by the need of agriculture, but there's a strict astronomical orientation and access ramps associated with the concept of sacred structure stairs. The Department of Archaeoastronomy did some geomapping and concluded that most of the pyramids are oriented towards the southeast and northwest. Southeast is the direction of the volcano on Pico Island, but more importantly, northwest corresponds to the setting of the sun on the summer solstice, which happens very close to Pico. The remaining pyramids have a perpendicular orientation to the first, and Fernando Pimenta, who's the director of the organization, admits that, quote, "It seems to be intentional and not just a coincidence. The geographical orientation of the buildings and the site selection for its implementation." So when we consider that the sea levels have risen over 400 feet since the late Pleistocene, then it could be said that the Azores Islands may represent the mountaintops of whatever landmass this was during the Ice Age, which mythology calls Atlantis, and seems to have been what the Atlantic Ocean was named after. The Azores are also situated on what geologists call the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is where new ocean floor spreads out in the form of hot magma, and this is also where two massive tectonic plates meet. So in other words, we should also take into account that in addition to the rising sea levels, there's an actual rising and lowering of these plates at this point in conjunction with the perpetual volcanic activity that is relatively normal in this area. One typical spring day, sailor Dio Cleciano Silva was sailing his yacht around the Azores Islands. He was startled to find that his GPS equipment was picking up something unusual. It registered a large, perfectly square object below. Whatever this thing was, it had the surprisingly similar geometric resemblance to a pyramid, but was submerged 40 meters off the coast, with an area estimated at 60 meters tall and symmetrically even. The global positioning satellite imaging recorded that the structure was not only in the shape of a pyramid, but apparently oriented by the cardinal points. So this is where things get really interesting.
40 meters under the water in between the Third Island and St. Michael's. The base is higher than a football field. The pyramid was detected by the The sailor here mentioned. He mentions that it's very impressive due to its form and its orientation. I mean, the vertices are north and south, so they're literally, correctly, geometrically, literally speaking. His longest experience in the sea never had brought such an impressive discovery, and he found this out 5 months ago when he was looking for new spots for fishing. So, this has always been a mystery between South Africa and the Spanish Canary Islands and the Azores. So yeah, by the precision of the lines, this sailor really has the belief that this has an ancient origin. And yeah, since decades that people are searching where this stuff were. And I don't know how to say this really, but there was always expeditions from South Spain in looking of these islands. But yeah, in resume, what this is telling, he's just telling the stories of the searches over the years and how he and how nobody ever said anything else, like a lot of rumors on the internet, which everybody knows, like the story in BBC years ago and other stuff, you know, because there's been quite some interesting facts.
Could these submerged structures be remnants of an Ice Age Cro-Magnon civilization which eventually populated Europe, North Africa, the Levant, and the Americas during the Pleistocene? When one considers the academically accepted Cro-Magnon ancestry of the ancient Amazigh or Berber races of North Africa, the Basque people of Western Europe, the Guanche natives of the Canary Islands, and the now extinct Native American tribes of the Eastern Americas, the notion that Christopher Columbus, or even the Vikings, were the first to cross the Atlantic becomes unrealistic and overtly dismissive. It is difficult to ignore the revered esoteric symbols found on both sides of the Atlantic and litter all over the ancient Mediterranean, and even more difficult to discount evidence of 2,000-year-old Carthaginian-style burials found on the Azore Islands, which coincide with the time that Rome was victorious over the Phoenicians, many of whom were said to have fled to the seemingly familiar Americas. There are many reports of ancient Hebrew being discovered in the New World, which is a type of script that is almost indistinguishable to ancient Phoenician. That said, regardless of the mounting evidence for ancient transatlantic contact going back all the way to the alleged time of Atlantis, one should be careful not to assume that everything in the Americas, including Mexico, Central and South America, were the result of Phoenician, Mediterranean, North African, European, or even Atlantean settlers, because there's a considerable amount of culture that is unique to the New World. For example, certain styles of writing that differ from anything that was diffused by the Phoenicians or Aryans, which modern academia calls Indo-European, or like calendars used by the Mesoamericans, which seem to be more complex, intricate, and precise than the standard old world calendar the world uses today. Speaking of the Americas, I'm in Calabasas again, a word which comes to us either from the Chumash Indians, which I'm told likely means where the wild geese fly, or from the Spanish word for pumpkin, squash, or gourd. I'm not sure which is correct, but right next to this nice little pond filled with turtles is the Marmalade Cafe, which is famous for its breakfast and claims to serve California cuisine. I ordered the garlic shrimp linguine, which is shrimp simmered with chopped garlic, lemon, white wine, and butter, tossed in linguine with capers and Italian parsley. Of course, this dish is not really Californian, but Italian. And towards the end of the 18th century, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who loved traveling in Italy, kept a diary where he praised his love for Italian food, particularly its pasta, and in a poem wrote, quote, "We are all pilgrims who seek Italy," after his return to Germany from the land he had long dreamed of. Which brings me back to the dreams of the German people, particularly before World War II, when Germany led the world in archaeology, rejecting anthropological fakes and frauds such as the Piltdown Man, and instead pursued forgotten history put forth in ancient mythology from around the world regarding humanity's ancestry from ancient civilizations which met their demise through global cataclysms. While modern academia now rejects the notion of Atlantis having ever existed, it's not because it's an obsolete idea that has been replaced by something more scientifically viable, but by theories that are more politically viable. We live in an era where social engineering is the driving force in education, and until that changes, I will just sit here with my red balloon until we are once again allowed to dream. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.